Support for the Exchange Podcast from NHPR comes from you, our listeners,
and from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. Fall in the Granite State is peak time for outdoor recreation, from leaf peeping to hiking to hunting. And this year, a small state agency involved in all of these has made big headlines, New Hampshire Fish and Game. From bears showing up in urban neighborhoods to lost hikers and hunters to the long debate over who should fund Fish and Game, the agency has had its hands full this autumn. So today in The Exchange, we've invited Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando in to discuss these issues and more. And of course, let's hear from you. Our email, exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange, or give us a call, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. And Director Normando, welcome back. Good to see you.
Good to see you, Laura. Thanks for having me.
Let's start with the bears, because this has been a big headline, but also, Director Normando, because I think it demonstrates the complexities of the behind-the-scenes wildlife management that the public doesn't usually see. So bears in downtown neighborhoods in Concord, including my neighborhood, bears in the local park where people walk their dogs, bears along a busy route in Manchester, urban bear sightings are way up. What's going on this year?
Well, you got to remember that bears basically do three things. They eat, they sleep, and they have little bears. So at this time of year, they're on a major feed binge, getting ready for hibernation. You know, if you look out in the what's going on today, which you can just driving around, we have a case of squirrel Armageddon going on the highways.
Squirrel Armageddon, I've heard it called,
right.
Yeah.
And there's some other critters that are having these same problems. And the bottom line is we've had a complete failure of the nut crop this year. So there's no acorns, no beech nuts in the woods. And all of these critters are not in the woods. They're traveling looking for food. And in the previous couple of years, we've had great mast crops. And so most animals, bears being no exception, they're fecundity ability, the number of cubs they have is a lot related to their caloric intake. So when feeding's good, they have lots of cubs.
So it's the same story. We did a whole show on the squirrels and their sort of life cycle. And I can't tell you, Director Normando, how many comments I still am getting about that show.
Right.
So it's the same cycle. Lots of acorns during that mast year last year.
And the year before in certain parts of the state was big also. And so now we have sort of abundant critters with a much smaller wild food availability. And that creates critters going into conflict with people in a much bigger way perhaps than normal.
Well, that's interesting. And, you know, I've lived in Concord 23 years, and I think this year there have been more bear sightings in my downtown neighborhood than ever before.
Right.
So,
and there was actually some sightings in Portsmouth where I live the other day, too.
So let's talk about the sighting in Manchester that caused some controversy, Director Normando. Your agency received a lot of flack about the way two cubs were killed in a busy section of Manchester. Lots of traffic, lots of apartments. Residents there were upset that a Fish and Game officer killed the cubs as they were heading for the highway. What's the officer's rationale there?
Well, first of all, he wasn't an officer. He was a biologist. And contrary to what most people may think, the majority of our wildlife conflict work is handled by biologists, not by Fish and Game conservation officers.
I see.
His concern was simply that they were going to get out into Route 3A there, which is highly busy, and cause a major traffic accident. It was, you know, afternoon. So that was just a public safety decision made at the at the moment.
Had he been called to the area anyway?
Yeah, they had. He had been there with a conservation officer who had called him earlier in the day. And at that time, the cubs were up in a tree, and they were hoping that the sow would come by and collect them, if you will. But he came back in the afternoon to check things out, and things went down the way they did. And obviously, it was a bit of a public relations nightmare, but it is, you know, it is one of those things. I mean, the fact is we have gotten a dozen or more cubs out of trees this year that, of course, we get no press or credit for that have been brought to rehabilitators. This was or to the rehabilitator, Ben Killam. And
he's up in Lyme, right?
He's up in Lyme.
The bear whisperer.
Yeah. I should point out, he's like the only guy in the country that does this. In most states, they just let the cubs either starve or they euthanize them because they can't make it on their own.
So he prepares them to go back out into the wild? Is that what
correct.
He does?
That's correct. He raises them on his property till, you know, they're yearlings and able to work, survive on their own, and then they get them back into the woods.
A couple more questions real quick, Director Normandeau, on this bear situation broadly and the specifics in Manchester. And then I do want to turn to a bunch of other issues before your agency, including this legislative commission, looking once again at the funding.
Yeah.
A lot of people in this Manchester situation have said, why did you have to kill them? You could have tranquilized them. Wasn't that an option, Director Normandeau?
Not in the situation that they were in. When the biologists went in there, they were on the ground. But what most people need to understand is, first of all, the drugs that we use to tranquilize with, depending on the animal, take it 5 to 15 or 20 minutes to actually have the animal go down. You know, we're not using fentanyl and drugs like that because they're too dangerous for the employees. But nevertheless, these drugs are controlled and in our possession under permit from the Drug Enforcement Agency as a sub-permittee under the auspices of Steve Crawford, who's a state veterinarian, and he's the one who actually has got the drug permit.
So those take 15 minutes to take effect.
They
so
can.
When you see it on TV, you
right. If you're
the
watching,
video is cut.
You know, someone of my age remembers the old Mutual of Omaha's Wild Kingdom, you know, where Stan is shooting out of the helicopter, and the minute the dart hits the critter, it drops and Stan's on top of it, and Marlon Perkins is up in the chopper. And that is not the reality.
There's a little bit of an edit there.
Right. And furthermore, we are not allowed to drive around with those drugs in the vehicle. We have the main office and a couple of our regional offices where that stuff is under lock and key. And so when we have a scenario with an animal that we're going to dart, for example, we did one in Manchester right after this episode where there was a bear in a tree down on, I think it was Oak Street. It was a cub, so we put a team together, 2 to 4 people go down there. They're prepared with the drugs. The animal's in a tree. It can't run around and get anywhere. They were able to actually get it with a jab stick as opposed to a dart gun, and they take the time to set a net up under the tree so when the animal falls, it doesn't get injured hitting the ground. And that cub got taken to Killam's. We very rarely dart animals that are just standing around on the ground especially like a public situation because especially with a bear or a moose in that 15 minutes. A lot of bad things can happen.
Who knows what could happen, especially in a densely populated urban
setting. If they're not happy with getting a dart in them. So it's really a different situation than what people may perceive. They probably think every officer, every biologist is running around with a dart gun hanging in their pickup truck, you know, and that is far from the case.
So this biologist did not have that medication in his or her truck.
No.
Okay. Didn't have that option.
And even if he did, these bears were running around. There was no, there was no opportunity there to that he would have had to really use it anyway, as opposed to, like I say, a static situation.
Where the bear's up in a tree.
Where the bear's up in a tree.
Instead of running out into the highway.
Right. And I might just add here that because, as I mentioned earlier, these bears are roaming around looking for food so prevalently that we have had a lot of sows killed on the road along with other reasons. But the fact of the matter is there are a lot of cubs running around.
Yeah, now that's an interesting point. So the sows are looking for food. They get killed, and then the cubs are waiting for mom in the tree.
We had right after the last Manchester incident I mentioned, the biologist left Manchester, went up to exit 17 on 93, reported two cubs in the center of the road, and they did not find the cubs, but they did find a dead sow that would have been killed by a vehicle.
So the bears, cubs are taken off.
And, you know, several at least of the cubs that we have captured have been in kind of rough physical shape, which shows that they've been away from their mother for quite a while, so she's probably gone.
Dr. Normando, let's take some calls and then we'll talk some more. Again, our phone number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. And let's go to Glenn first, where Chris is on the line. Hi, Chris. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Fine. Go ahead, Chris.
Good. Okay. Recently, I heard that a bear was shot at a dumpster at one of the AMCs. I'm not sure if it was Pinkham or if it was Crawford. It was the lodge, though, I do believe. And I'm wondering if Fish and Game is aware of it and if Fish and Game did shoot the bear.
Okay.
And if they didn't, how is Fish and Game going to address the issue?
Thanks a lot, Chris, for the call. And I don't know if you know any of the specifics around this incident.
That's the first I've heard of that. We have a lot of problems with bears in dumpsters. We try to educate people because killing a bear at a dumpster just means the next bear is going to come. It's not until you secure those dumpsters so they can't get in them that they'll stop coming.
Seems pretty basic.
Well, you would think so, but the dumpster companies really don't want to do that because it means that the guy who's in the truck has to get out and unlock the lids before they flip them into the truck, as opposed to just driving up, flip, and going.
I see.
But towns like Lincoln and Bethlehem that have put in play town ordinances that require their dumpsters to be locked have made huge inroads in their bear problems because of, it's about easy access to those calories. And the easier the access is, the more the bears are going to be there. And a lot of bear conflict is really about human activity and what we can do to educate people as millions of times as we've talked about people just bringing in their bird feeders, they still don't do it, you know. And the next thing you know, they look out and the pipe holding the thing up has been turned into a bow tie out in the yard.
I have seen that myself.
Exactly.
Yeah. So to Chris's point, though, if Fish and Game didn't shoot this bear, you know, are you going to address it? It's my understanding that it's perfectly fine under New Hampshire law to shoot a so-called nuisance bear.
Well, it's really a law related to property and agriculture.
I see.
So if a bear is doing, you know, damage to your property, threatening damage to your livestock, by state law, you can, in fact, and that's not just bears, that's wildlife generally.
All right. Thank you for the call, Chris. Again, our number 1-800-892-6477. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. You can respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. And Director Normando, I want to turn to an issue that you and I have talked about dozens, hundreds of times, and that's how the Fish and Game Commission is funded. Who contributes, who doesn't, and why? First off, what are the major three or four sources of funding for New Hampshire Fish and Game?
The major sources start with hunters and fishermen. that's about a third of our revenues is the various license fees that come through that. Federal funds are the next big piece. That it's another third or so of our money. And the biggest, although there's a variety of those sources, the biggest sources for that is Pittman-Robertson and Dingell-Johnson monies, which are federal trust funds that come from a federal excise tax at the wholesale level on hunting and fishing equipment. So again, substantially, sportsmen are paying that freight. And then we have a lot of different dedicated accounts for, say, the Access Program or OHRV or whatever that constitute the balance of everything. And some of those are sports-related, like the Habitat accounts, sportsmen-related, I should say. And others are, like OHRV, or more just something we've been tasked with doing.
Yeah, and I read, I think, that OHRV, that's ATVs, most
right.
people call
ATVs
them.
ATVs and snowmobiles.
Oh, I see. Okay, off-road. Highway.
Off-highway recreational vehicles.
So I read that that's actually become a big, big source of cash for Fish and Game, right? Because so many people are riding the wilds, the ATVs up north and so forth.
Well, remember, though, that it depends a lot on the winter because the majority
sure.
of those funds are still snowmobile registration.
I see.
So big winter is big money. Also, over 70% of that money, because we do the registration, it's in our budget, but it's just a pass-through to us. And it goes over to the Trails Bureau at what used to be DRED, Department of Natural
Resources
Cultural
and Economic
Resources.
Development.
No,
yeah, they've changed it.
I've been here too long. I can't get DRED out of my mind. But so in an average year, about 72% of all of those revenues go to Bureau of Trails, and we keep the balance, which does law enforcement. It pays for the administration of the registrations, which is a significant amount, and also the education component that's required.
So here's an email from John in Durham about this idea of fish and game funding. John says, could the state start charging a parking fee at trailheads that are on state property, Franconia Notch, for example? This would be similar to what the White Mountain National Forest does at numerous sites. And John says hikers are used to paying the fee. He says this could raise money to be used for search and rescue. I'm wondering whether this suggestion has been looked into. And John, thank you for the email.
So, of course, all the trails and all the state park system, again, is part of another agency. So there would be probably
New Hampshire State Parks.
New Hampshire State Parks. Or forests and lands. And so I think that, and they have their own starvation problems also. So I'm not sure that that is sort of a politically viable scenario. Also, I'd like to mention that search and rescue, which seems to command all of this attention because it's in the press a lot, is a big issue. But it's not by any means our biggest financial issue.
It's not the biggest drain on your finances.
It's not the biggest drain on finances.
All right. Well, that's interesting. And coming up, I'm going to get your thoughts, Director Normando, on another suggestion similar to John's. And John, thank you again for the email, that the federal government pick up the cost of rescues in the White Mountain National Forest because it's federal land. And I know that's kind of in play. So I'll get your thoughts on that in just a moment. And we'll take a lot more of your emails and calls. So keep it right here. This is The Exchange on NHPR. This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today, New Hampshire Fish and Game Director Glenn Normando is with us on his agency's role in New Hampshire's Great Outdoors. We're taking your questions and comments about some of the headlines surrounding fish and game recently. We'd love to hear from you. Send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org. Respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or, of course, give us a call, 1-800 1-800-892-6477. And Director Normando, right back to our listeners. And Rick is on the line. Go ahead, Rick. You're on the air. Welcome.
Good morning, Laura.
Hi.
Morning,
go ahead,
Glenn.
Rick.
Good morning.
Yeah. My question was relative to the study commission. As you know, we've discussed a number of different issues relative to finances, but we seem to have avoided the efficiency and effectiveness conversation around the makeup of the Fish and Game Commission. And I just want to get your take, Glenn, on if you thought that broadening the representation on the commission would help with the revenue stream concerns of the department.
Well, and this is absolutely what we should talk about, Rick. So thank you for bringing that up. And I've got a ton of emails on this as well. But just to highlight this for the audience that may not be as invested in these issues. So the commission is 11 people.
It is one from each county and one from the title towns.
Okay. And you have to be a hunter or an angler to be on the commission.
The requirement is that you've held a hunting, fishing, or trapping license 5 of the previous 10 years.
So, and some.
And no violations within 5 years.
Right. So, no poaching or illegally taking
right,
fish.
Right.
Well, so Helen sent us an email to this point about the idea of broadening the representation on the commission. Helen says, according to a Cornell University on cash strapped fish and wildlife agencies around the country, those agencies that were able to change their governance and widen their support base, i.e., not only cater to hunters and trappers like ours do, they were able to solve their funding problems much more successfully. Helen says the study commission that Director Normando is part of is supposed to include governance in their discussions, but the commission refused the topic they are charged with, despite strong criticisms from the public. Why, Helen wants to know. So, Helen, thank you. And Rick, thank you. And I'd love to get your take on this governance issue, Director Normando.
So let me say that the commissioners are governor's appointees. The director does not have control or supervision of the commission. In fact, to some extent, it's the opposite. The commission has amongst other authorities, it's the commission that sends names to the governor for the director.
Oh, no, that's interesting. And sorry to interrupt you here. So unlike the, you know, Jeff Myers, the head of Health and Human Services, he's appointed by the governor, he's in charge, and the people who work on the issues work for him.
Right.
Yours is a little different.
I'm a little different. And it's got a, you know, it goes way back historically, and it's similar around the country. Most states have a commission in one form or another, but they vary, and their authorities vary state to state. So, you know, we've heard a lot about, you know, broadening the commission. There's been lots of openings in the commission and lots of people from all sorts of places that, if nothing else, at least have fishing licenses. So it's always kind of bothered me that there's a lot of criticism, and yet there's also been recently, I mean, Governor Sununu has completely changed the commission. There's only four or five left of who was here before him, and several of those will be on the block shortly. And so it seems like, for some reason, people don't come forward that are potentially, you know, representing another point of view.
Although they have to have a hunting and fishing license.
Or
fishing license.
But, you know, I mean, many people have fishing licenses. And but, you know, it's also a politically charged issue, very politically charged. And because, you know, as usual, there's kind of a polarization of opinion where, you know, the hunting and fishing sort of what I'll call our, you know, our old school constituents are concerned that this is just a way for people who are against hunting or fishing to get in and try to change, you know, everything that's important to them.
To get on the commission and
right,
start pushing back against
pushing
hunting.
Back,
and especially trapping. That seems
right,
to really
trapping,
upset people.
Trapping gets people upset, although if you go to a state like Massachusetts where they've banned it, you'd see a host of other issues associated with it, with the lack of trapping. But anyway, going back to animal conflict. And the other side, if you will, you know, is saying, why should we put money in if we don't have a, you know, some kind of a voice?
Sure.
So it's, you know, it's.
Well, what do you think, Director Normando? I mean, that's the existential conflict. Fish and Game says, hey, we don't have enough money to do all these things that the public wants us to do. And you guys do a lot. On the other hand, there isn't any representation from, you know, boaters and hikers and wildlife photographers and so forth. So they're like, why should I kick in?
Yeah,
I don't
well,
know what you think about that.
Well, I think it's a chicken and an egg deal.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I was struck a couple years ago. I was in a meeting and my counterpart, who at the time was the director in Georgia, great guy named Dan Forster, was sitting next to me. We were outside of Las Vegas in the largest wildlife national wildlife refuge in the country, the Desert Wildlife Refuge. And we're looking out the window in this conference room, and these people walk by, and, you know, they have $4,000 or $5,000 in optics hanging around their necks, both of them, you know, Swarovski bullet binoculars and all of this stuff. And Dan pointed over to him and said, look at all that, and not a dime for conservation, you know?
Sure, but
unlike,
they're not represented on the commission.
Unlike
so.
The 10% that hunters and fishermen pay on the equipment that they buy.
Right.
That goes into these federal grants that we get.
So what do you think? Do you want to tap into that potential resource, but in so doing, allow, you know, bird watchers on the commission?
Bird watchers. I think that that it, you know, for me personally, it needs to be a step up and be responsible, and, you know, be willing to, you know, you talk about chicken or the egg. So that's give me access and I'll pay, or I'll show you that I'm serious and give me money and give the agency money first. I'm kind of a give me the money first type of guy, because I do feel that show us how serious you are about and help us legislate some things that would be helpful to the agency.
Well, we got an email to that effect from a listener in Ware, and I want to thank this person. I can't read the whole email because it's a little bit long, but this person says, I pay quite a bit into the New Hampshire Fish and Game budget, but the commission does not represent me. I'm a taxpayer, and monies from the general fund go to Fish and Game. I own a gun and go to shooting ranges to practice. The federal taxes on ammunition I purchase circles back to Fish and Game. I have a hike safe card, and I have a registered ATV. All of these fees amount to far more than any hunting or fishing license, yet the commission, this person says, does not represent me. The commission must have a hunting or fishing license, and I do not hunt or fish. Instead, I spend my time in the great outdoors with my camera, on my small farm, or hiking throughout the state. This person says, I'm not against hunting for food. I'm against the commission catering to hunters and trappers and not considering the input of other citizens like me who contribute more than our share of the cost. So this is basically summing up what we've been talking about, Director Normando.
And, exactly.
And just to sort of sum it up and then move on, I mean, we've been talking about this for a long time. It's kind of like, you go first, no, you go first.
Yeah. Well, it's worse now, not better, because we're living in apparently a political world where nobody can talk to each other anymore without screaming. So, you know, I really don't know what to say about that. I mean, I understand where that person's coming from. And they're correct. The thing is that, you know, some of those things he said are right. I mean, we are getting some general funds now, and we sort of had to survive. And the legislature and the governor has recognized that. And so that up until now, it's been very very minimal amount, but, you know, if things stay the way they are, that may have to change somewhat, because you know, it's salaries and benefits are well over 50% of what our costs are, and it takes people on the ground to do what we do. And you know, the recent collective bargaining agreement is you know, great for state workers, but it's another $500,000 a year that we're not seeing any increases in our income. So, you know, those sorts of things are what, when your income is fairly steady and those sorts of cost increases continue, that's where the issues arise.
Well, speaking of the staff, we got an email from Elaine in Nottingham who says, my husband and I are crazy about the program Northwoods Law on the Animal Planet channel. We hope New Hampshire Fish and Game will always allow Animal Planet to make this program. And the conservation officers are our heroes, especially when they rescue hikers. Elaine wants to know, are the officers really as nice as they seem on TV? Elaine, what a great question.
Yeah, well, do I really have to answer that?
Yeah, right. That's the kind of question.
I would say that our, generally speaking, our officers are pretty good. They're very professional, I won't say that it's never happened, but I rarely get a complaint about our conservation officers.
Well, in fact, we got an email from Christian. Thank you for that one, Elaine. Christian sent us an email. He says, what are some suggestions for people looking to join New Hampshire Fish and Game as a conservation officer? What type of preparation should candidates be working toward? And how likely is it that positions will be opening up in the near future? We keep hearing about the aging workforce and, you know, baby boomers getting ready to retire. Here's Christian wondering if there's some openings there.
There is. And there probably will continue to be because, number one, people are retiring. The age of the state workforce is a whole nother topic that could fill a couple of these things up. Secondly, law enforcement in general across the state is looking for people, and it's getting tough to get people. They don't want to live the hours that a conservation officer has to do.
You got to be on call anytime.
You're on call all the time.
You've got to be fit.
You got to be fit. In fact, our fitness tests just to get in are more extensive than, say, state police or whatever. We add swimming and a few other things. So I tell people who are interested two things. Number one, live a clean life because you're not going to like the lie detector test. So when little kids would tell 10 years old, I want to be a conservation officer, I tell them, you better be good because the lie detector test.
Don't steal any candy from the candy store.
Yeah. And then secondly, you need to come in fit because it's amazing how many people will come in and they immediately just fail the fitness test.
So if I were a Christian, you know, where would I go? Like on the website, you know, employment opportunities, just check that out.
You know, okay. The state has a major website for any openings in state government for work. And so that's where everything is.
Well, you got to be pretty fit to do some of those rescues
exactly.
That we've heard about. And I'm going to ask you later about a high-profile rescue that got a lot of play on social media recently. But let's take another caller, Director Normando. This is Mead from Keene. Hi, Mead. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Go ahead, Mead.
So my question goes back to the beginning of the program when you were talking about the large number of prey species that are out there now, squirrels and mice, porcupines and that sort of thing. So my question is, why hasn't there been a corresponding buildup of predators like foxes and fishers, which you would normally expect to happen at the tail end of a big prey population boom?
Sure. Mead, it's a good question. Thank you so much.
So I'm probably not the best qualified person to talk about that. We do know that there are some issues going on, not everywhere, but locally with some of our predator populations. Rabies is always out there when you hear, rabid foxes, rabid bobcats, and that sort of thing. We've also had some distemper issues going on with red and gray fox as well as fisher in some locales.
So those are the predators that normally would help reduce populations of squirrels and mice.
You know, the thing is, too, of course, there's a lot of predators, you know. I mean, think of birds, you know, hawks, owls, eagles.
We've got lots of those raptors.
I everything seems to have a cycle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we understand some of the disease stuff that's out there. But I can't say that I'm an expert in by any means in that area.
Well, we did get an email from someone upset about fish and game hunting and trapping of some of those predators that you mentioned, Director Normando. Christina in Chester says, please ask the director how he plans to move forward with the department and hunting, trapping, fishing rules if commissioners continue to disregard the proposals suggested by staff biologists based on available data of species. For example, Christina says commissioners overrode a proposed take limit on fox and instead voted to have an unlimited season. Christina says this is despite a uniform proposal from all staff biologists suggesting a limited take of fox for the season due to the species showing a sharp decline. So I wonder how those decisions are made, Director Normando. The biologists, according to this email anyway, say, look, the foxes are having a hard time. Let's reduce the hunt. But then the commission says, no, we're going to have a regular hunt.
Right. So that was a topic of discussion, to say the least. I mean, the commission has certain authorities, one of which is hunting and fishing regulations. The staff advises where we think things should go. And at times, the commission disagrees. And I would say by far more often than not, they don't disagree. In this case, we had data to show that there's been a drop-off, but it wasn't a drop-dead
A decline, but not precipitous.
Well, our data had some precipitousness about it, but the data itself is quite limited, and so it was not something that we were going to fall on our swords over. I mean, in fact, they did actually reduce the fisher take, which was part of that, but they did not reduce the fox takes.
So. All right. Well, thank you for that call and that email. And a couple more emails, not about hunting, but here's another hunting email that I do want to get in, Director Normando. Fran tweeted us to say the state is awash in wild turkeys. Am I correct? The hunters are only allowed to bag one turkey per season. Isn't it time, Fran asks, to increase the number? And she says, not to two, more like six. I have to say, my dad lives in Manchester, and I've been driving down to Manchester a lot lately. I've seen 10 turkeys on the side of the road, you know, Interstate 293, not out in the woods, so.
Yeah. So remember, turkeys are in the same boat as everything else. Their major food is acorns and nuts on the ground. So they have come out to the roads, especially to see if it's raining when all the bugs and worms come up. So they're really visible given circumstances right now, number one. Number two, most people who aren't my age won't remember that turkeys were extirpated in New Hampshire for 125 years. The last one seen was in Ware in 1854, I believe. Fish and Game put them back in the state in 1975.
Reintroduced them
with 25 turkeys. And if you want to talk about a success story, now I got people saying, you know, we need to kill more. Now, we do actually allow two turkeys a year.
I'm going to cut you off, and I apologize for that. Fran, thank you for the note.
Dedicated listener Joanne Harden of Rye has included NHPR in her will and trust.
It may not be the biggest trust, but I want to be able to pay back what I feel I've received so the people coming after me will be able to enjoy that.
Leaving a gift to NHPR is an inspired way to support an organization that has enriched your life and that of others in your community. To learn more about including NHPR in your estate plans, go to nhpr.giftplans.org.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Canoy. Today, New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando on his agency's mission from hunting and fishing to search and rescue. Let's hear from you. Lots of calls and emails coming in. Our phone number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can always respond on Facebook or Twitter at NHPR Exchange. Or again, give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. And Director Normando, let's go right back to our listeners. John is in Windham. John, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Hello, Commissioner Doe. My question is about climate change. I was wondering what kind of changes you're seeing happening in New Hampshire related to that, and what
John, go ahead. Did we lose you there? Okay, we lost you, John. I apologize. But it's a relevant point, and one we hear a lot about from your biologists.
Yeah, it's hugely relevant. It's, you know, likely part of what's promoting the, some of the problems we have with moose, because the winters aren't as hard as they used to be, and it allows those ticks to, that are parasites on moose to survive a lot easier. You know, I, amongst other things, used to commercial fish years ago, and I have still maintain a commercial lobster license that I run enough traps to make believe I'm still have a hand in it. And I can tell you that the changes I see just down at the seacoast are immense in terms of, you know, 15, 20 years ago, you never saw blue crabs in your lobster traps. You never saw black sea bass show up. I mean, we're getting a lot of species that used to only be south of Cape Cod that are coming up. And, you know, for me, this is all a real thing. I live on the water in Portsmouth. Enjoyed, you know, 4 or 5 inches of seawater in one of my buildings this past winter. One of those storms, exactly. So, you know, I see it every day, and I've been watching it for 15 or 20 years, and it is a happening thing.
Well, so we've interviewed tons of politicians this year. We interviewed all the primary candidates leading up to the primary, and then we've been interviewing the major party nominees. And we've heard from more than one politician, Director Normando, that they don't think climate change is really a problem. What's your message to them, given what you see?
Well, it may not be a problem through the next election cycle. It's a problem over the next couple of decades. One of the frustrations of being a fish and wildlife in fish and wildlife management is nothing happens in a 2 or 4 year cycle. I mean, I mentioned those turkeys earlier, 1975 to today. You know, we're talking however many 40 years to get them where they are. It took us 10 to 15 years to reestablish the tern population off the Isles of Shoals. You know, we deal in a timeline in fish and wildlife that is well past the time horizon of the election cycles. And that is true, maybe even truer, of the whole climate change issue.
Well, we got a question from Melinda on Facebook about the moose, since you mentioned that, Director Normando. 70% mortality rate of moose calves in New Hampshire this year due to ticks. Melinda says we need to act. It's not natural selection because this didn't happen naturally. Melinda asks, can we deliver medicine at salt licks or when moose are tagged? Melinda, thank you for the question. I want to let her know and everyone know that we're going to do a whole show on the moose situation on Monday. So maybe we'll address the medicine question there. But what are we seeing in terms of moose mortality?
Well, this is one area where drought is good. Okay, so when we, you know, ticks need moisture. A couple years ago when we had a substantial drought through the summer, we saw our mortality of calves go down to 30% the following year because the tick population had taken a dive. And her numbers are correct. In a typical year, we have been seeing about a 70% calf mortality.
Wow, that's huge.
Of our radio collared calves, and that is because they can't withstand the anemia and whatnot brought on by those ticks. The older animals can, although it reduces their weight. It may cause the cows to abort calves and such like.
Oh, that's so sad.
Yeah, it's a tough situation, and it's an ugly situation if you ever seen a moose with 140,000, 160,000 ticks on it.
Well, and I saw some pictures of moose on your website yesterday, and they don't look like the pictures of old. They look skinny and raggedy, and I appreciate the Facebook comment, Melinda, and we will talk more in a more detailed way on Monday about the moose. So thank you so much, and be sure to tune in Monday.
Mean, Pete Pekins has forgotten more than I'll ever know about moose, and so has Chris Rhine. So those are the people to talk to.
We'll be talking to some of those folks for sure. Another caller, Jane from Wakefield, is on the line. Hi, Jane. Go ahead. You're on the air with Director Normando.
Yes, I have been listening very carefully and with respect to Director Normando, but I have to take exception with him laughing at the idea that bird watchers should have a voice in how money is spent. He talked about the partisan divide and how people are not speaking civilly to each other in this political atmosphere. And I wonder how he thinks dismissing some people's activities and laughing at it, dismissing it, how does that help having a discourse about this issue, the money that they need, and other people could contribute? Well, I'll take my response off.
Well, Jane, I appreciate the call. And bird watching is a huge, huge activity for some folks. I have some friends who are into it, and it is enormous. And they spend a lot of money traveling and on the fancy binoculars and so forth. So go ahead, Director Normando.
And you know, I certainly wouldn't laugh it off. In fact, we have a very close relationship with the department, with the Audubon Society. They are under contract with us to do a lot of their bird work because we don't have in-house experts. And we are also financially helping to support the Amuskeg Fishways, which are run by them. You know, I don't know if I got misinterpreted there or whatever, but I have no axe to grind with bird watching. And in fact, it was a big thing for me, especially when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. So,
well, I wonder if your reaction was in part anticipating the reaction that you would get from the commissioners.
Absolutely. Not the
who don't want outside interests on this commission.
Not the commissioners, but but some of the folks on the other side, because this is exactly the fight that is out there.
Yeah, well, Jane, I'm glad you called, and we can give us a chance to clear that up. And here's another issue that I want to raise with you, Director Normando. It's a big, big issue in New Hampshire, especially over the summer, and has to do with boat launches. Michael in Warner emails, New Hampshire does not have a readily accessible all-tide boat launch on Great Bay. What is preventing the state from improving the existing launch at Hilton Park? As a New Hampshire resident and saltwater angler, I'm wasting time and gas to drive to Elliott or Kittery, Maine, each time I fish, and paying those towns a $20 per launch fee. Michael, glad you emailed, and let's talk about the saltwater boat launch, but also more broadly, you know, there's long been a complaint that some of New Hampshire's best lakes are kind of tied up by people who have the wealth to have a house on the lake, and the rest of us kind of look at the lake and go, wow, that looks really nice.
Yeah, well, let's generally say that it's all about the money, okay? So our boat, we are part of the access program, or we are the access program. So I get $5 from every state boat registration that goes into access, which amounts in a typical year to $450,000 or so. That's the same $5 we got in 1992 when we were assigned the boat access program.
Wait, 1992 was a long time ago.
A half a million then, but a lot more than a half a million today.
Right.
In addition to that, we get some money from the aforementioned Dingell Johnson federal grants. There's a piece of that that's for access that we use the state money to match. Altogether, the access program has about say $1 million in revenues a year or thereabouts, or $1 million, I should say, more accurately to say, in available money. But we have 140 access sites that we own now. And across the whole state, a substantial amount of that money is being used simply to maintain what we have. If you look at the acquisition cost of a couple of acres of water, of deep water frontage in tidal waters, you know, let's say it's going to cost us $2 million to buy a piece of property. The only way I can really do that is if I go to the state during budget time and try to get a capital appropriation, which is, you know, a difficult scenario to go through.
So given New Hampshire's limited coastline, you would have to buy a piece of property, find it, spend $2 million acquiring it, and then spend more money building the boat
exactly.
launch.
Exactly. So that, as an example, okay, people often talk about Hilton Park. Fish and Game does not own Hilton Park. Hilton Park, or the launch and all there, is part of the Turnpike Authority. And we have talked to them at length about and numerous times over the years about that property. Because of its bonding, the Turnpike Authority needs fair market value for that land, either in lease or in fee to purchase. It's a complicated financial issue to turn that money over. Meanwhile, we can't access the federal funds unless we as an agency have control of the property for at least 30 years, because the federal government is saying, if you're not in control of the land, we won't give you the money, because we want to make sure we get the benefits. So
I see. That's tricky.
There's been a lot of conversation, but not much in the way of answers there. And again, as usual with all these issues, it comes down to how much have you got to spend.
Well, I appreciate the email, because again, this is a longstanding issue. People want access to the water,
right,
to fish. More people might fish, and that's the goal, right, of Fish and Game, if they had access. So, but in some places, access is quite difficult.
It is, and or expensive. We don't charge for our ramps because people are paying out of those, to stay on their registrations. There are two good ramps, one in Rye and one in Hampton, that are run by Parks and
New Hampshire State Parks.
New Hampshire State Parks, that's correct. They do own some ramps around the state, too.
Well, here's an email from Greg in West Ossipee, who says, my interactions with the fisheries portion in the Lakes region is always very professional and informative. More people, Greg says, need to understand Fish and Game provides lots of education opportunities through Let's Go Fishing, through Owl Brook. Greg says the upcoming Salmon Sunday is a great opportunity for families to see firsthand the department in action, as well as to see landlocked salmon up close. Greg says, I wish there was more visible promotion of what's available, maybe tying into town recreation departments, physical education at schools. More interactions might create more allies and supporters. This gets, again, to this point about you guys do a lot but in the state, but the general public isn't tied into your funding. So that's another idea from our emailer.
It is correct. First of all, for example, I don't have a marketing person anymore. Why? Entirely Fish and Game funded in a budget numerous years ago. That position went out the door. I mean, it's like, you know, again, it's tough to market yourself when you don't have the resources to do so. Also, we do put a lot out there, but people's attention is in so many different places today, and it's difficult to make some sort of personal contact with every person in the public, although there seems to be an expectation today that somehow we'll do that, and that it just makes it tough. We put out, we have our magazine that goes to 5,000 people. We have 10,000 people on our email list to get all of our, notices and whatnot.
How active are you guys on social media?
We are a fair amount, and
I've seen a fair number of fishing videos myself, but
yeah, so we try to be out there on social media, Facebook and whatnot. We have people assigned to that in the department. We have people full time on our website to try to keep it, up to date virtually daily. But it is a task to sort of break through the multitude of noise that comes from every direction.
Well, I really appreciate the email. And talking about social media, perfect segue for my last question for you, Director Normando. A high-profile rescue of a duck hunter and a return of stolen property. So a win-win, lots of Granite Staters, including many who don't follow Fish and Game at all. We're really engaged about a story concerning an elderly duck hunter who got stuck in the mud up to his neck for 33 hours, rescued by you guys at Fish and Game. First of all, congratulations for the rescue. It was pretty dramatic. How does somebody get stuck in the mud up to their necks and live for 33 hours?
Well, that's a good question. I mean, had to be a hardy individual. I'm not sure I would have made
it. I'll say.
But, Luckily, he did. My understanding was he realized that the, and again, I'm not familiar with all the details of the situation, but, you know, realized that the more he struggled, the deeper he was sinking into it. It was you know, very swampy, wet conditions that he was in hunting. You know, again, perfect for ducks. And so the, but they did find him.
33 hours stuck in the mud. Yeah. And you talked about social media. The kicker is, while your officers were rescuing this gentleman, their trailer was stolen,
right,
as the Bartlett police put it, pretty low move, dude. but social media, right, helped you catch the thief?
Well, they actually had a camera, so we had the individual sort of on film. And what had happened was they launched a boat to try to, because this is swamp sort of along the river's edge or whatever, right? So they launched a boat to be checking the area out from the water side. Then the conservation officer needed to get over to a different site, so he left the trailer there so that he didn't have to drag it around. And someone saw the trailer there and said, oh, freebie.
But there was a picture taken. You guys put it out on social media.
Right.
And you found the guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, so that's a twofer.
Yeah, that was a twofer.
Well, Director Normando, it was really good to catch up with you, and there's a lot more we could have talked about. I also want to thank everybody who took the time to email and call. Sorry we didn't get to you all, but we really appreciate your input. And Director Normando, we'll see you the next time. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Laura. Thank you for calling me, having me in.
That's New Hampshire Fish and Game Executive Director Glenn Normando. And a reminder to everybody, we will be talking in a lot more detail on Monday about the moose situation with the conclusion of a 4-year study of New Hampshire's moose. So we'll check out that story on Monday. This is The Exchange on NHPR.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.